right, thank you guys so much. All right, so I do want to take this time. We want to take this time to introduce our two special guests. Really great story about how we were able to meet. I was listening to his podcast that he was a part of, the Unerased podcast. And at the end of the story, and they go, and he now lives in Paris, Texas, with his husband, Larry. And I was like, whoa, what great time. This is amazing. So I reached out to him on Facebook, and they were just super gracious. So never met him. I just sent him a message and was like, hey, we're starting a church. We would love for you to speak. And I'm just hoping I get a message back. And he immediately responds and is like, sounds great. How can we help? So he's just really, both of them really are that kind of guy. Just active, loving, seeking to do what they can. And I think you'll see from the story, like whatever they do, it's all in. And that's something that I can just always appreciate. So we just want to take this time now to welcome them and take the opportunity to hear their story.
Can y'all see me from here?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Let's just, it's hard to follow that. Can we all just pause? Just pause and close your eyes and just rest for a moment. Just rest. Thank you. My story is long, and I don't have time to share it all. But I want to try and focus on some main points. When I was 19 years old, I was very naive, inexperienced in many facets of my life, and I chose to shut down some of the pain and difficulty that I had been going through by getting married. I thought that in being married, I would not have to feel the things that I had struggled with so much. And so a girl that I had known in high school and I got married. When I got married, I entered into very traditional Midwestern suburban life. We had two daughters, and I had goals in life, but they were very 20-something goals, very minimal, very materialistic. I was not involved in any kind of religion or faith at the time. I was raised Catholic, but when I became 18 or 19, I decided it's time for me to not have to deal anymore, so I chose to not continue. So Chris and I, my first wife, lived life every day like any normal couple with kids. But I remember from inside me, I would look around at society. I would look around at people I would encounter. And I realized I felt extremely strange and challenged and different. I would look at other men with great desire, but not knowing even what that meant. I didn't know what that meant sexually. That was nowhere on my periphery, and homosexuality was nowhere on my periphery either. That just wasn't anything I'd ever even thought about. This was back in the late 70s, and a very different time, a very different era, when we didn't talk about things like that. It just wasn't on the forefront. By the time I'd been married about 6 years, I'd had several very extreme disappointments in the marriage. I couldn't seem to find a way to meet my wife's needs or who she was or me as a person. And finally, someone that I worked with started mentioning the word homosexual, and I thought, oh my gosh, that word was like blinking red neon lights. It's like that's it. That's who I am. That's really the truth for me. I engaged in a conversation with a guy that I worked with that I knew was gay. We all kind of just knew he was gay. It's one of those things where everybody just kind of knows. We didn't talk about it, but we just kind of knew. And in that conversation, I admitted to him what I was feeling, and he said, duh, I've known that for a long time about you. You know, I'm thinking, really, how could you know something about me? I didn't know about myself. So at that point, I engaged in an extramarital homosexual encounter, and at that point, I just thought, that is the missing piece to my puzzle. That is exactly who I am. That suits me, it fits me, it's natural, it just seems to be reality for me. And so I immediately went home and told my wife that I wanted a divorce, that I was gay, and at that point, I came out, my family knew, everybody knew, this was in 1979, and I really had no concern for what anybody thought. It didn't bother me one whit. I separated from the marriage, got divorced, went into, I lived in Omaha, Nebraska, and I moved into an area of town that was known for the gay community, and I felt like I was home. It's where I fit. Everybody knew I was out. I didn't care. I was comfortable in it. I didn't feel any conviction because I wasn't involved in any kind of religion or faith to have any contrary view to that. But I started struggling relationally. I was 25 years old, and some guys that I dated were not what I really expected from a relationship, and it was very disappointing and discouraging, and I was struggling with that. And a girl that I worked with told me, oh, well, you know, I've been divorced, and I've struggled with alcohol, and she was very authentic and very real and very open and very comfortable, and she said, but I met Jesus. And I think that's where you can find help, you know, if you meet Jesus, if you, you know, but you know what the Bible says about homosexuality. And so I got my first little message that something about me needed to be corrected by someone who was speaking from a Bible. And I didn't know the Bible. I didn't know much about it. I'd heard about it. I'd, you know, heard it at sermons at church on Sunday or whatever. But so something kind of struck me, and I thought, well, maybe she's right. Maybe that's true. And so that, without all the other details that led me forward, because I really want to talk on some other points more detailed, but that led me into a path of evangelical Christianity. And in that decision, I did feel convicted that I needed to separate from anything that was gay. So I broke up with my partner. I moved into a church community. It was a singles adult ministry. And I found people that were loving and kind and caring, and I just really, really loved being there. It was a singles group of about 80 people, about this size. We did everything together. We hung out together. We were honest and open with each other. I started a pantomime clown ministry that we did, and we just had a blast. We had fun. We traveled. We went on vacations together. It was a community. I loved the connection. And my homosexual past was known by my closer friends and by the pastor, but it was a non-issue. To me and to them, it really was a non-issue. It wasn't anything I focused on. I loved where I was. I felt fulfilled relationally, and so I wasn't really necessarily hungry for that kind of connection at that point. But I also didn't want to be alone the rest of my life. And so I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to get married again, I got to figure out this woman thing. I got to somehow sort that out. And surely God's powerful enough to do that. You know, everybody says it was a Pentecostal church and believed in the power of God to do anything, and homosexuality is wrong, so that's not an option. It doesn't mean I don't feel it, but it's not an option, so I have to break away from that and can't do that. So I met a girl in that particular ministry, and we became good friends, and she seemed compatible, and she knew about my past life, and I knew about hers, and there were no secrets, and I thought, well, this is the way you start a good relationship, honesty and authentic and all those things, And so as we got closer together, I started to feel that emotional door slam on me again. And it was scary. It was frightening to me because I thought, I have to succeed at this. This can't fail. But I'm shutting down. I'm closing off. And I don't know what to do with that. And so in that situation, I heard a story on radio program called Focus on the Family, James Dobson. And they said, we have an informational sheet on ministries that help people that are gay. And so I wrote letters to Exodus International at that time. This was 1983. I wrote to Love in Action, and I got letters back from a couple of them, and then I got a phone call from Love in Action, and they said, we are looking to hire someone to be an assistant house manager in one of our residential homes and wondered if you would be interested in applying for that. Well, that was kind of ridiculous at the time because I had a full-time job with the railroad. I'd been there 13 years, and I had two daughters and life and all kinds of stuff, but I just felt absolutely strongly that that was God's answer, that God was speaking directly. That was the direction I needed to go. And every single minute detail, this is where confusing life starts to happen. Every single finite detail took place over a 3-month period, financially, practically, everything in it, for me to move to California and start working at Love in Action. And I didn't have to push anything. I didn't have to press in. It just happened. Everything just happened. And so at that point, I thought they are the experts because they supposedly know exactly what they're doing. They have history and they've got knowledge and supposedly they had success. And the couple that led it were a married couple, a mixed orientation marriage couple. We didn't say that back then, but that's what they were. I thought they can help me figure out this deal with my girlfriend. And so I went there and really thought everything lined up. I loved it. I loved the community. I lived in a house with 12 other people, and I loved that. As you can tell, I'm a community person. I love people. I love relating. I love the daily connection. And so everything seemed to be exactly right. And before long, I decided it was time that things had kind of moved on and we could get married. So I asked Valene to marry me, and it was one of those God moments, and I thought, you know, the answers had come, and so we got married, and from the moment of the I do's, I knew that there was something horribly wrong. I knew that something was not at all right. But as at the time, and in the culture I have been in for many years, we believe that divorce was wrong. I mean, once you marry for life, and now I'm on my second go-round of being married, and I certainly can't fail at this, so I'm stuck. There is no out. And so I have to just stay. I have to work this out day by day by day. So for 24 years, we chose not to have any children. For 24 years, every single day, I would just suck it up, and everything in me to try and find a way to make this day go by. We were compatible. It seemed like we had enjoyable times. We did some traveling. We had some family. We had friends. We were involved in churches. But every single day, behind the wall of this facade was a miserable, suffering failure in my mind. I got involved. I'm still working for Love in Action. I worked for them for 22 years. Brought the ministry to Memphis, Tennessee, and for all intents and purposes, Love in Action was very, very successful. We were the largest ministry of our kind in the nation. We're the most well-known. Everybody around the country and in other countries knew of us. We were famous in those cultures. I had a lunch relationship with all the senior pastors in town. I really thought I had arrived. I thought that life was working for me, with the exception of this secret behind the scenes that my marriage was not what it appeared. I remained faithful. I remained committed. I remained steadfast. Every time we would hear teachings on husbands and wives and loving and the church and all those things, I really tried my hardest to emulate that. I really tried to be everything I was supposed to be. I tried hard to be everything a Christian was supposed to be. I tried hard to be everything a leader is supposed to be. I didn't want any part of my life to fall short, because in my belief system, God would only honor my heart's desire to someday be attracted to my wife if I were absolutely 100% faithful. Because if I broke that in the least little bit, then I would lose the outcome. And I would lose God, and I would lose friends and community, and I would lose everything. And so everything in me just became so rigid. I became a legalist. I became so committed, like you said, all in. I was all in. But everything I was all into, I was all out of me. You know, I was gone. I became an image rather than a person. Every year that I continued to press into this, I would lose more and more of me. And it's because I couldn't be the fun-loving, creative, colorful, unique person that I am and stay away from everything gay. Because if I leaned into anything, any culture, any community, any hobby, any situation that had any threat at all of a gay person even being there, I couldn't go there because I perceived the temptation would draw me back. And so everything gay was like an alcoholic in a bar. Anything that had anything to do with gay, I had to avoid and stay away from, with the exception of the ministry I was in, meaning everybody that came there was gay. And everybody we dealt with, and every day I talked about it, and every day I, flushed out things that were gay. But that was different, because that was all on the side of what we called repentance. That was all on the side of change and of being obedient and of following God. So it was a challenging 22 years. But during those years, something happened, and this is where I'm going to bring all this up to date, and I'm willing to answer questions if you have them later. My life's an open book. I have no secrets, so, I'm not afraid of being honest about whatever needs to be said. But so we're rolling along. The ministry is the most successful numbers-wise and everything that it could be. I mean, we had a $750,000 a year budget. We owned a 5-acre property with 20,000 square feet of buildings. We had, we were doing everything we could to be everything we wanted to be in the whole ex-gay world, with the exception of success, because success was something we didn't have. But one of the things around the Exodus network that I was a part of, the leaders that I had known, I was on the board of directors for Exodus for 11 years. If you don't know Exodus, do y'all know who Exodus is? Have you ever heard of it? Exodus International. Okay, Exodus International was a national coalition of ex-gay ministries. From a very conservative Christian viewpoint, believing that God had called to gay people to repentance and that he would change and heal and transform and all those things. And there were about 120 ministries at this time around the country that did this kind of work, everything from a small counseling office to, like what we had, a full residential program. And so we're moving along, and we had this, we were going to move into this big property we just bought, and it was June 6th of 2005. Which is actually D-Day, and it became D-Day for us. And every year on June 6th, I send messages out to people that were connected to that day as far as what happened in our lives. But on June 6th, a young man named Zach, who was on MySpace, sent out a message, said, "My parents are forcing me to go to this gay camp, and I don't want to go." He was 16 years old, and he was coming to Love in Action for our day program. So it wasn't really a camp, it was a day program, but anyway, that's what he called it. And his MySpace blog became viral. It went absolutely around the world in as things do when they go viral, as things do now and did then in 2005. So what happened is a man named Morgan Fox organized a bunch of young people to come and protest at our ministry office. And that happened on June 6, 2005. I remember that morning, our secretary came to my office and she said, "John, there's protesters outside." And I said, "How can they be there? How do they know we're here? This is our first day to be in this property. How does anybody even know we're here?" And we found out it was because of Zach's blog. And so the protesters were out there, probably 30 of them, giant rainbow flags and all kinds of poster boards and all kinds of stuff. And all of a sudden the news media showed up, and life has never been the same for me since. It was absolutely one of the most effective protests I think anybody could ever arrange. They were kind. They were nice. They told me God loved me every day when I drove out of the office, because they were there for like weeks, every morning and every night. I was interviewed on the local news 25 times in 2 weeks. Do you remember the protest, Terry? Terry Brown is here with me and her husband, and she knew me back then. So here we are facing protesters, and then all of a sudden the Child Protective Services came to our front door. "I understand you're abusing children here." And I said, "What do you mean?" And so that became a big deal. And then the Drug and Alcohol Commission came and said, "We understand you're doing a drug treatment program without a license." And I said, "What do you mean? We have a drug and alcohol council here, but that's not who we are. It's not what we do, blah, blah, blah." And then the mental health people came by and they said, "We understand you're administering medications and you don't have a license. We're going to shut you down and lock your doors." And this was like 6 months and then 8 months, and things just kept unraveling and unraveling and unraveling. Everything just became out of control, and it started creating all kinds of struggles within our staff. We had 15 staff members, and everybody started getting at odds with each other, and things were becoming tense and irritable, and I was struggling. And by the time 2 years came by, this was in the fall of 2007, with this, all this is still going on. And by the way, June 6th of 2006, the church that I'd gone to, which was a 10,000 member, 7,000 daily Sunday attendance Baptist church, on one Sunday went down to 1,500 people. And it was because of an inner struggle between the unofficial elders, because they didn't have real elders, the unofficial elders, which were the men with the checkbooks, and the senior pastor and his staff. They became at odds with each other, and the staff and the senior pastor said, "We're done. We're not playing this game. We're resigning." And so five staff members resigned. 5,500 people decided we're not going to go to church today at this church. And it was a major, major blow up. I'd been to the church meetings. I'd been to the leadership meetings. People hit people. They were rude. They were horrific. It was horrific. It was embarrassing and painful and challenging. And I was over it. By that point, I was over church. Like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And at that time, kind of the missional movement started going along, and house churches and books started coming out about alternative ways of experiencing church, alternative ways of being community. And I thought, that's me. That fits me anyway. I never have liked all this performance stuff. I was afraid to wear jeans to church because I was a Christian leader. You know, I was so legalistic, and I had gotten so trapped in this treadmill of big, giant performance church model that this finally gave me a reason to say, I'm going to be me for once. I'm tired of playing the game. That really has never suited me. It's never been who I am. I really just am this. I just want to hang out with people. I just want to be people with people and talk and share and relate and be in community. I don't want to do all that. And so it gave me a reason to start exploring a lot of other things. And so 2007, I decided it was time. It was time for me to leave Love in Action. And people, I heard later that people earlier in my vocation there were taking bets on what it would take to get John Smith to leave Love in Action because I was so committed to it. They thought, he'll die here, you know. He'll be buried in the courtyard. I mean, he'll never leave this place. But trial and tribulation and discouragement and inner conflicts brought me to that place where I said, okay, I'm done. And I resigned from the ministry. And when I resigned, I had no plan. I had no vocational career plans. I didn't have any college education. I didn't have any past experience other than being a clerk at the railroad. I had nothing. And I turned to God, and I said, God, surprise me. Because I have nothing. I have nothing. Just surprise me. And I had no idea. I had no idea what that moment did in my life. Because God surprised me really meant that I'm throwing it all out, and whatever you bring my way, I'm open to it. Because I don't hold anything anymore. I have no expectation. I have no plan. I have nothing. One of the first things that happened after I said that is a lady who I'd known since 1994. She's a filmmaker, and she'd interviewed me on several occasions, and she has a whole history bank of incredible interviews that if anybody ever got a hold of them, they'd be worth a tremendous amount of money because she's been doing it for years and she's got this collection and I'm part of that collection. And so she interviewed me at different points in my journey, and so each interview was a little bit different. So she and I were talking, and she said, John, you've left Love in Action. Yeah. And she said, well, what does that mean? And so we started talking about that. And she said, I don't remember what brought the conversation up, but I brought up a man named Michael Bussey. Michael Bussey was one of the co-founders of Exodus in 1976. Michael Bussey was one of the first XX gays. Michael left Exodus after about 2 years. He was married to a woman, to his wife, and he left his marriage and got into a relationship. At the time, he couldn't get married, but a committed relationship with another man. And so all through the years at Love in Action, I'd heard about the horrible life of Michael Bussey. That he had fallen, he'd backslidden, he didn't love God, he wasn't repentant. And I mean, this was not uncommon in the community and in my office, you know, to hear people talking about Michael Bussey. And so when this girl brought up Michael Bussey, have you ever met him? I said, no, you know, Lisa, I've never met Michael Bussey. And I said, well, he's not repentant. You know, I was still in my legalistic phase. He's not repentant. And he left his wife and he's never made amends for that. And, you know, what's that all about? And she said, well, John, she says, don't you think that's a little bit strong and maybe rude of you to have such strong opinions about someone that you've never met? And so I said, yes. Yes, that's bad. And she said, well, how would you like to meet him? I said, well, I think I need to meet him. I think that's the right and responsible thing to do because I have to be. I need to be. And so she said, well, I can arrange that because he's a personal friend of mine. Oh, okay. And I just said all these horrible things about Michael Bussey. So she arranged a phone call, and I talked to Michael Bussey. And that phone call was another one of those life-changing moments because Michael Bussey was not the man that everyone told me he was. The rumors, the gossip, the backstabbing, all the things that were said did not reflect the Michael Bussey that I met in person. I subsequently did meet him in person later, and it still proved to be true. He was an incredible, endearing, kind, loving, God-centered, spiritual person. Very humble, very easy to talk with, very just everything, almost the antithesis of everything I'd heard. And so the reason that conversation was so significant to me is because I started then to realize that I had not been told the truth. And I had not been told the truth about a lot of things. I began to discover that there were lots of lies, and there was lots of deception, and there were lots of excuse making, a lot of dishonesty across the years and across the divide of the culture that I had become a part of, the church culture, the ministry culture, and I became very distrustful in a good way. I say in a good way because I finally stood back and said, I really need to open my mind up now to listen for truth because I had been brainwashed, really. I'd been brainwashed by a lot of religious stories and a lot of religious teachings and a lot of ex-gay stuff. And so as I began to ask those questions, I recognized that there was a particular focus that a lot of ministries had, especially ex-gay ministries, a lot of churches. At that time, there was a big movement going on, and I think it probably still is to some degree, but it was all anti-pornography. It was all about how pornography ruins lives and ruins marriages, and you know that was another one of my things where I knew I had to absolutely stay away from it because it was, you know, addictive, and it was all these things that people told me. And so I was sitting in my office, and I think, you know, I don't have an allegiance to anything, anyone, or any organization. And in my lifetime, I had never looked at pornography. I did look at, in my younger years, some paper pornography, but I'd never looked at internet. I'd never, ever gone on an internet website. I'd never, ever did that because that was one of my fears. If I do that, I'm going to lose everything. I can't do that. Sitting in my office, I said, you know what? I'm going to look at pornography. And I opened up the computer and pulled up some pictures, and immediately this horrific cloud of shame just poured over the top of me. It just enveloped me. And I said, oh my gosh, what have I done? Because the anti-pornography culture gives you the instructions for what you do if you find yourself looking at a picture. And I'm talking about addiction. I'm just saying look at a picture. And the immediate thing is you go tell everybody, you get accountable, you tell your wife, you make amends, you repent, you go to your church leaders, you begin to, and I sat there and all that was flooding over me, and I felt this presence. At the time, clearly to me, it was the presence of God. It was Jesus sitting in the chair next to me. And what I heard was, what are you thinking? You know I'm here. And it just struck me, and I thought, okay, omnipresent. That means that there is nowhere you go where he's not. And he's entering into this conversation with me. Not shaming me, not beating me over the head, not ridiculing me, not scolding me, not all those things, just a conversation. And he said, "Well, why are you, what are you thinking? You know, what's," and I said, "Well, I was curious." "Okay, well, I understand that. You're curious. Okay. Is there anything else you want to look at?" "Well, no, not really. Not right now. Not with you sitting here." And I just had this thought. I said, "Oh, no, now I have to go tell my wife." And I felt this these words. And he said, "And you think you need to go tell somebody, don't you?" And I said, "Right away, like, yes." He said, "No, why do you need to do that?" And he said, "Why do you need to shame yourself like that? Why do you need to shame yourself?" And it was like, again, this life-changing, life-altering moment. I did tell people. I'm telling you all. I mean, I didn't have to hide it, but I don't have to shame myself in it, you know? And that's what struck me. And I look at that point as I finally, for the first time in my life, found grace. And I thought, that is what's been missing. We never knew that. We taught grace. We didn't know grace. And I thought, that has to change. It has to change in me. I have to become a grace giver, not a rule holder, not a challenger, not a shamer, but a grace giver. And from that point on, the way I treated people changed forever. I became a different person. It was amazing. At that point, I started looking back and I started evaluating. What have I done for 22 years? What did I teach? What did I believe? How did I lead people? What was our success rate? What was true? What was valid? What was bad, harmful, wrong? And I contacted an organization. It was at the time an online paper called Ex-Gay Watch. And I says, "Okay, you know who I am. You've been watching my life for years. You know, I've been your enemy. You know, I understand all that. But here I am. This is what I'm doing. What should I do? I feel like I need to go public with something. I feel like I need to speak out about what has happened." And this guy, in a very terse way, "Well, you need to start with an apology." And I said, "Okay, I get that, you know." And so that man at Ex-Gay Watch helped me to write my first stab at writing an apology for the ex-gay ministry years and what I had done. As I began to compile what that looked like, there was a guy that went through our ministry who was very much against me. He became very antagonistic, and I had felt it, and there were all kinds of, he put up all kinds of boundaries, and I had opportunities at times to run into him, and I said, "I can't let this go on. We have to reconcile this. I need to make this good between us. We've got to heal this rift. It has to happen." And so on several occasions, I would step into it, and we'd have a conversation and get a little ways, and then the wall would go back up again. And finally, I said, "Okay, I'd like to run something by you. I've written an apology, and I want you to read it for me and tell me what you think. And I'm sending it to you because this is what I want to say to you." And so I sent it to him, and he sent it back. And he said, "I've rewritten it." And he said, "If you can agree with what I've changed, I can accept that apology." And it was very, very wise. It was a very wise re-scripting of what I said. It taught me a lot. And I said, "Yes, absolutely. You know, that is true. I want to say that." And so that became my written public apology. And it's in my book, which I've got copies if you want some. But I wrote that, and that is what I sent out. That's where I started with the whole apology thing. Then I went to I was introduced by Lisa to another gay Christian person. His name was Todd Farrell, and he was the president of an organization called the Evangelical Network, and they have annual conferences and do other things. And so I had a conversation with Todd, and again, I'm thinking, this is strange. This is a gay guy, and he's telling me that they're serving communion on the Castro in San Francisco. And I told him, I said, "Todd, do you realize How many churches would think you'd lost your mind? Do you know how many churches would condemn you for doing that? Because, you know, communion, you can't serve communion to those heathen gay people in the gastro. You can't do that. He says, oh, I know. I hear from them. But he said, I've never been any place I'd rather serve communion than on the gastro. People who have been restricted, who have been refused communion at their own churches their whole life. Are you kidding me? These people are starving to feel connected and received and welcomed and loved. He says, every year at Easter time, we go and serve communion. And I said, well, Todd, you're really a different cut. You know, this is a whole new thing for me to meet people like you. I've never known gay people like you. I think gay people could be like you, you know, because I wasn't one of them. You know, I was still kind of in that other space. And he said, well, why don't you come to our conference? Well, I can't do that. I don't have any money. I can't travel. You know, I want to invite you. I'd like you to come to our conference. Well, it worked out. I was invited to speak at an ex-gay parents conference in Spokane, Washington. And that was the first conference where I changed my whole content because of the new things that were going on in me. And so it was a very different conference than I'd ever led anywhere else. And there's still people that I have on Facebook that went to that conference that are friends with me. And it was really good. It was really a good conference for parents because all I taught was love your kids. I mean, it was really very, very different. And as it happened, that conference paid for my way to Spokane, and I have a few extra dollars. I did a circle trip to Southern California, and so my trip was covered. And I stayed with some friends down there who were parents of a guy who went through our ministry. And as I got to share with them, they invited me to stay with them. I found out that they were on my side of the camp. They had done a lot of changing as well. And we sat and just had heaven for 3 days. We just had heaven sitting in their home. They'd come to some of our parents' conferences and that kind of thing. And we were on the same track. We were learning the same things about life, and we were opening our minds to the same things. And it was just really wonderful. And they're very close friends of mine today. And anyway, so the guy drove me to this conference, and I said, Mike, you realize that you're like taking the man into the den of sin, don't you? I mean, nobody knows I'm here, and if the people who know me back home knew I was going to a gay Christian conference, they would not like that. That would not be a positive thing. And we're riding in his vintage Corvette, and I said, well, I've never ridden in one of these. I love cars. So we're driving along the interstate. I'm talking to him about him taking me to the den of iniquity. So we went to this conference, and the stories at that conference were more and more just overwhelming of love and grace and freedom and incredible character and openness and authenticity and honesty. And I met a trans woman that was leading a worship service on Sunday afternoons for trans people. And I thought, oh, women can't be preachers, much less a trans woman leading a church service for trans people. You can't do that. And as I'm going, This does not compute with my history, but it resonates with my soul. It really resonates. What have we missed? Oh my goodness, we have cut people because of our cultural opinions, because of our faulty Bible teachings that we've believed were true that aren't, and all kinds of stuff. And I'm talking to this woman, and I'm just overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed with her. And then I met these two guys that were in the hot tub. They were young puppy love guys and dancing around and having fun. And so we got to talking. They said, yeah, we decided not to go to the beach because we thought it'd be too tempting for us. You know, we're kind of trying to live a good life. And I thought, gay people with conviction about going to the beach? This doesn't compute either. I mean, these are gay people that are doing what we try to get people to do for 30 years. You know, trying to learn their own boundaries and discover what's right for them and be healthy about it and open and learn and grow. And that's who these two guys were. And I thought, oh, this has blown me away. And I went to a six-hour workshop on the Bible and homosexuality. Well, we were never allowed to read that stuff. You know, you couldn't read pro-gay theology. It was wrong. That's just all you need to know. So I went to this six-hour workshop, and the guy that taught it was very thorough and very well-studied and very well, he communicated in an amazing way, and I don't listen for more than 10 minutes, so I hope whoever you don't listen more than 10 minutes, you can hang on a little bit. But anyway, I have low attention span. I hung on to that six-hour workshop. I mean, I totally hung on to it. When I was done, I was again amazed at how what he taught resonated with me you know, those anti-gay teachings really never made sense to me in the past. So I didn't really pay much attention to them. I thought, well, that makes sense. I don't understand. What you're saying doesn't... And this guy's going through these seven clobber passages, and I'm thinking, you make sense for the first time in my life. You're making sense. This is true. This rings true for me. And at the end, I went up and I said, Joe, what you're telling me is that you believe that the Bible has been taught in some ways with an anti-gay bias. And he said, yes. And I said, you're right. I believe you. Because I know how that can happen. Because I know that we can make the Bible mean whatever we want it to mean. And if we really, really, really don't like gay people, or the men who primarily were involved in interpreting the Bible were really uncomfortable with the thought of gay men doing that, it'd be very easy for them to read those passages into an anti-gay teaching. But as he spoke things like Sodom and Gomorrah, when he said, all the men of Sodom, I'm thinking, all the men of Sodom? I mean, they're all gay? All the men of Sodom were gay? I mean, it's just started. I started, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. This isn't what this is about. And in 1 Corinthians, speaking of the whole passage of such were some of you, which we loved as ex-gays, you know, such were some of you, you were washed, you were changed. Well, that isn't what that passage means at all, and that's not the point. That's not the point of the passage. I'm not going to go into it. If you want to read about it, there's plenty of ways you can. But I just started to realize this guy is teaching in a way that really makes sense contextually and culturally and interpretations. It makes sense to me. I came home and there was a guy that I met with every week, like a Bible scholar guy that I met with a friend of mine, and we'd go over Bible things and we'd talk. And I said, Stacy, okay, I just went to this conference, because he knew I was open with him about that stuff. And went to this conference, and these are the passages they taught. I want you to go through them with me, every one of them. And let's sit down with your Bible knowledge, with your intellect, with your history. Let's go through these scriptures. So week by week, went through every one of them. And after we were through, I said, so Stacy, do these scriptures teach against homosexual relationships? Am I correct that they do not? He said, you're right, they don't. Now, this is a well-known Memphis, Tennessee Bible scholar. And I said, so? And he said, I still think it's wrong. I said, okay, well, that's your opinion. But we have clearly stated here that the seven passages that people use on a regular basis to clobber homosexuals into submission do not do that. And he agreed with me. But he's in a position. He can't move. Without major earthquakes. So it was very, very significant for me to do that. And then I went to England. I was still married to my former wife at this time, and a friend of mine, Jeremy Marks, was an ex-gay ministry leader who I met in 1987. He went over to London and started his own ministry, and I supported it, went over there. We mentored each other. We were close friends. In 1999, Jeremy wrote this letter about I'm thinking differently now. And he looked back at his ministry and he realized there was no success. And he said, there has to be another way. This doesn't work. And so he began to change his viewpoints. And at that point, I wrote him an email. I said, Jeremy, the Bible doesn't say anything positive about homosexuality, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is back in the day. And so our relationship separated because I couldn't handle his looseness with the Bible. And I was still in that judgmental, critical place. And I love Jeremy. I love Jeremy. I loved Jeremy. Great, great friend. He came over to my wedding with my wife and took pictures. He was a man who took Charles and Di's pictures at their wedding he was the church photographer. He had the seat, the best seat in the house, you know. I mean, Jeremy is an incredible guy, very proper Englishman. And so anyway, Jeremy and I reconnected with my amends and asking him to forgive me and my groveling over my horrible way of treating him way back when. So he invited me to come over to a conference he was doing, and it was my first attempt to really, again, connect with my wife, especially with a pro-gay, gay-affirming Christian conference. And she willingly went and seemingly enjoyed herself. And one of the messages there was about the communion table. And I'd never heard this before in my life. Never. And he said, who invites us to the table? Whose table is it? Then how can a church say anyone can't come? It's the table of Jesus. He's the invitation giver. Who are you to say someone can't go to someone's party? You're not the person sending the invitation. And I thought, oh my gosh, you're right. You're absolutely right. And every church I've been to refused communion to lots of people, intentionally or by implication. And I came home, and all of a sudden, boom, another great shift, another major shift. And I thought, wow, we have just really been wrong. So I'm moving along, starting to grow, starting to learn to love gay people, starting to pursue reconnection with men and women that have been through Love in Action. 475 men and women went through our residential program in the 22 years that I was there. I have a list of all of them. One of the things I took with me when I left the ministry was the names, because they're important, because they're people, because I love them. I always loved them. I loved them from the moment I met them. My love was distorted because I was distorted, but I knew I needed to change that. I knew I needed grace for them. And so I started pursuing reconnections through Facebook, thankfully, you know, the world's yellow pages. It's wonderful. And so I was able to find connection, and now I'm over 200 people that I've had reconnection with, I've had conversations with, and many of them are very good friends of mine today. And they're, what I discovered in my reconnection is that Love in Action success rate was about zero. Because no one ever changed their orientation. No one. The success rate of people not any longer engaging in a same-sex relationship, probably about 80 to 90% of them have. And as I heard their pain, and I heard their struggle, and I heard their wrestling, and I heard that we were a part of that, that the messages we gave, that the implications we delivered, that the attitudes we had, and by my hiding my real truth, led them down paths that were false and wrong and disconnected. And so I really need to continue to open my ears to hear their pain. And it is overwhelming, but it's so full of grace. I was telling Larry today, I said, I hope I am, and I want to be, instead of the person who's always telling everybody how they should live, I hope and I want to be the person to hear how they're living, to hear why. The first person I called, the first person I connected with was a man named Kevin, who I knew was in a committed relationship, couldn't be married yet at that time, and they had adopted three children. I knew they had kids, and I had opinions. Oh, Kevin, he's living with a man, and what are they doing with those kids, and blah, blah, blah. And so I called Kevin and had a conversation with him, and the first thing I did, which was a stretch for me, was to say, Kevin, tell me about your kids. Which was a stretch, because I didn't think those kids should be there. You know, I was still back at that place. And he started telling me, well, one of them's special needs, and we've adopted him because we love him, and he's in a wheelchair, and he needs all this attention, and we just give him everything he needs. And then the other two were from a split-up family, and they wanted their boys to go to the same home, but they really wanted the one boy to go to a gay home because they thought he was probably in a pre-homosexual category, and they wanted him to be with a home that would not be at odds with him. And immediately I'm going, here you go again, John, you know, eat your words, because this is the best, most hospitable environment for these kids, and they love these kids. And what's so wrong about that, John? What's so wrong about that? How can you possibly condemn that? And so I went on from there, and numerous, you know, hundreds of other stories. And so the changes in the way I treated people were very much on my program. It's like I really need to make that difference. And by that point, you know, I'm receiving all of the attack letters. You know, I'm getting all the messages from all these hundreds of Christian people around the nation that are telling me that I'm sliding down the slope and I've been deceived, and pastors writing me, and some of them very, very loving. I mean, one guy, he's a pastor of a very large black church in Memphis, and I became real close friends with him and spoke at his church, and he was very fatherly and very supportive and very loving towards me. And so he wrote me this letter. It's in my book. I couldn't have been a more loving letter. I read it today. Larry and I read through it. And I responded very lovingly back. Didn't agree, and I stood my ground. But it was not from a biblical dissertation. It was from a soul level. It was from a people level. This is what I believe, and this is what I'm doing. And so those things started happening. And so finally, I'm moving along. My wife is very cautiously supportive, but she's not anti. She's in agreement about the grace and about what I'm doing and the way I'm treating people and all those things. And I got to the place where I looked inside and I said, I need to get honest about this marriage. I have to be real about what I have been feeling all these years. And the struggles became very pronounced as I became more honest. I realized that we had not been emotionally or sexually intimate for over 10 years. I realized that I was closed in and self-protective. I couldn't allow myself to be free. I was so, I don't know what the fear was, but there was just a tremendous anxiety internally that didn't show that I knew of. Found out later that people knew, they could tell, but they didn't know what it was, but I didn't admit it. And I got a hold of a guy, his name is Anthony Van Brown, who lived in Australia. And he wrote me one day, and how you doing, John? And he knew my story because he had a similar story. And he said, I want to know how you're doing. And I said, Anthony, this is the worst day I've had in months. I am just tied up in knots. I don't know where I'm going to go. Something has to change. It's just driving me crazy. And he said, don't you know that I have a specific 3-month life coaching program for men in mixed orientation marriages that are struggling? I said, no, I had no idea you had that. Gosh, I'm not a very good marketer, am I? And I said, no, I had no clue. And he said, well, how would you like to do that with me? I do it through Skype, and we have weekly meetings. And I said, Anthony, by that time I already met Larry. And I was talking to Larry that day. I'll bring you into the conversation now. Larry said, well, John, you have to find a strategy to work this through. Larry is very linear, thankfully. He helps me tremendously through his linear thinking. And he said, you have to have a strategy. And I said, Larry, I know you don't know me that well, but I'm like, strategy is not in my vocabulary. I live life by grabbing whatever's in the air. I'm not a strategist. So Anthony got him on the email, and he said, well, John, I provide a strategy. This is all in one day. I said, you're kidding me. You used the word strategy. You provide a strategy. Wow, that's amazing. So Anthony and I did a 3-month course. That was in 2012 in the fall. It was in October, I think. And it was every week. And the goal was to, in a traditional life coaching format, the goal was to establish the areas of your numerous parts of your life that are out of sync, that are off, that you're not satisfied with. And so we did this whole wheel thing, and it showed all these areas, family life and marriage and social, and all these things were way out of whack. Everything was all, my wheel was wobbly. So he took me through his 3-month course, and it was one of the most amazing and powerful things I've ever done for me, because he had no advice. He helped me discover through the program. I discovered for myself that my life core values, that have been my life core values my entire life, are authenticity, connection, intimacy, and faith. Those are my 4 life core values. And he helped me to see through the process that that's who I've always been. And my current life circumstances were inauthenticity, lack of intimacy, lack of connection, and my faith was all over the roadmap. And he said, John, no wonder you're miserable. Of course you're miserable. Who wouldn't be miserable if they were crossing over every one of their life core values? You're not living. You're not living you at all. And he said, what will it take for you to live in your life core values? And I said, I have to leave this marriage. And he said, okay, how can I help you do that? With the least amount of harm, in the most authenticity you can, in the most well-thought-out way as possible, I will help you walk through that. And so we began to process that. And in December of 2012, I went to my wife and I said, I'm asking for a divorce. And this is why. This is what's going on. There had been other conversations previously, but that was like the one where I drew the line in the sand and I said, this is an absolute necessity. I cannot continue living like this. And she accepted it, and she came back to me with a list, because she's linear also, a list, and she said, you can leave when you accomplish these tasks. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And that was our divorce decree. It was basically the financial settlements, the practical settlements, the business settlements. It was how we're going to manage bank accounts. I mean, her list was very, very practical. And so I accomplished those tasks and moved in January of 2013 and applied for divorce almost immediately. Larry and I met in 2011 at the Evangelical Network Conference. I was sharing a little bit of a story. Todd asked me to, and Larry came up to me afterwards and said, whatever you said at the time, I'm glad to hear what you said, or well, Larry's quiet. I was okay, and we found out we had a common friend, Jeremy Marks, in London, England. He'd been over there, and he'd met Jeremy, so we connected based on our common friend. So the next, I think at that time we connected on Facebook or something. I don't know, we did something. So we move along the year, and in 2012, I went back to the same conference, and Larry was there. I didn't know you were going to be there. I don't think I knew you were going to be there. But he was there, and I thought, you know, I need quality friendships. I'm developing a new life. I'm relating to new people, and I need those to be high-quality people. And I saw Larry was there, and I said, he's one of those people. He's high quality. I just know it. I knew who he, I could just sense that's who he was. And so throughout that conference, we talked and shared, and there were about three or four of us that were together at every meal, and Larry was a part of that, and we talked over our meals. And by the end of the conference, we were sitting there, and my shirt sleeve touched his shoulder. And I thought, oh, I kind of like this. And there was a drag show at a Christian gay conference. And I looked at him and I said, Larry, you ever been to a drag show? No. Never been to a drag show. I said, neither have I. This is interesting. It was Ray Bolts. Ray Bolts was speaking, and he brought in a drag choir. And I was just blown away. I was like, this is amazing. And I was amazed at these drag queens. I was amazed at their stories and the ministry that they do and what they shared about that. And I thought, no, God can't use a drag queen. But they were amazing. It was wonderful. I mean, it was just really, really wonderful. And it broke another one of those things in my life. And so Larry and I could tell there was a little something. And I'm thinking, but I'm still married. You know, I'm married, and I got that. Oh, I can't do that. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so we talked a little bit after the conference. My wife and I at the time were moving into we were downsizing, because I knew we were moving towards this divorce thing, and we were cleaning out and selling and kind of getting ready. And so we moved into a rental house, and I told Larry that I needed to build a storage building. I'll come and help you do that. Well, I've always loved to do projects with other guys, and you know, I'm like, I don't know how you do it, but I was not consciously aware that there was something going on, but there was, but I wasn't consciously aware of it. So I couldn't be; I was still married. So you came, and we built the building, and it was a very connecting time. I really enjoyed the day, and you stayed with my wife and I, and met my wife, you know, because there really wasn't consciously anything going on. There really wasn't at that time. So I said, well, hey, Larry, you got any projects at your place? You know, maybe I could come to Paris and work on a project with you. That'd be fun. And so in November, I came to Paris, and we call it the weekend. Because when I walked in the door of Larry's house, I immediately felt every facade, every guard, every self-protection, everything that I had been keeping up for 20 years completely just fall off. Because of who you are, and because of what I had been all those years. And there was no denying it. We spent the weekend, at one point Sunday morning, I'd gotten an email, and it really kind of struck something in me. And Larry, you had your arms around me, and I just started to sob, like almost uncontrollably. And I said, Larry, I've never cried with another human being in my life. I've never been safe enough with another human being in my life. And it was not a, there was no sex that weekend, just to answer your questions. It was all about what we felt and experienced at a soul level. And I couldn't deny it, and you couldn't deny it. And we went back, and of course we said, hey, you know, we cannot go any further in this relationship as long as you're still married to your wife. I mean, that's, no, that's not where we're going with this. Of course, you can't stop the emotional part of it, but boundary-wise and all that, we were very strong on that. And so, again, I moved forward and separated from my wife. And so in July of 2013, I moved to Paris, Texas, and Larry and I moved in together. And in November of 2013, we had a commitment service. Jeremy Marks came from England. Larry's mom was there, which was an amazing thing. Your sister was there. And I had friends come from Memphis. And we had a really, really wonderful faith-centered commitment service that we had a foot washing and I don't know what all else. We cut a cake and... Anyway, so that was November of 13. And then we moved on, and in November of 2014, we talked about getting married. And I said, well, there's only certain states, you know, where you can get married. And so we started looking. I started actually researching flights to go to somewhere where we could get married. And the week I was researching the flights, we heard that Oklahoma opened up to gay marriage. And so November 16th of 2014... We got married November 16th, right? I always think it's 15 and it's 16. I forget. November 16th. So we got married in Oklahoma and have been together since then. So it's an interesting journey. And I know we're time-wise. You know. Do y'all have questions? I'm open to, you know, if y'all have any questions you want to ask, you know, if you want to. Anything you want to say? Life goes on. Yes.
What would you say to the little boy that was in your camp and went through your ministry years ago?
Zach, obviously the first thing, you know, I have not had any communication with him because he's chosen to live completely off the radar. He went to college, completed college, you know, I have reached out, but I haven't had any response from him. My first thing would obviously be to acknowledge, you know, what we had done. But then from there, obviously, you know, tell him, please, 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 you know, whatever it takes, live you, be you, you know, you don't have to please anybody else, you know, you can't, it doesn't work, it's going to come back on you if you do, you know, just live you, be authentic, discover who that is, because I think for a lot of us, I know for me, I didn't have the freedom throughout my life to discover who I was. You know, so that's all new for me. I'll be 65 this year. You know, I didn't start learning who I was until I was 60. And what I'm learning is I'm who I was when I was 5. I've got a little grandson that's 8 years old, and when I looked at him when he was about 5, he's on the autism scale, and when I looked at his life, I just said, that's me. That's who I was. Colorful, expressive, creative, amazing, verbal, and I thought, that's who I was when I was 5 years old. He's me. That's me. He's got a mom that allows him to be who he is and nourishes who he is. I didn't. I didn't have that kind of a mom. But I looked at that, and I thought, that's who I need to be. That's why I have to keep discovering. And so I would do that with him. Please, learn who you are. Yes?
How did your children deal with these extremes of you got divorced and lived gay, and then you said, no, I'm not going to do that anymore, and then you said, yes, yeah. I am. You know, how did they deal with that?
I will mention my oldest daughter, because my younger daughter has other life issues that really kind of keep her on a neutral zone. But my older daughter was very distant from me, especially during those evangelical years, very distant, very hard. I tried everything in my power to try to figure out how to connect, and nothing worked. When I came out this second time, she wrote me, And she says, it was on Facebook, very public. She said, "Dad, I'm really glad you've decided to live who you are. And I want you to think about how many years you spent trying to fix something that never needed to be fixed to begin with. And I want you to think about what you lost." Powerful. Powerful. She is wise. And she said, "Do you think we didn't know all those years? Do you think I didn't see? I hated that church we went to. I hated that blood vessel popping, sweating pastor that was screaming every Sunday. I hated that. I hated sitting in that front row with you. You know, I never want to be in that again. I never want, you know." I mean, she finally got honest with me. And I says, "I get it, Alicia. I get it. I really do. I really do. I hated him too. She's very open, loves Larry, kids fine. She says, "My kids, we don't have those issues in our home. You know, we don't. My little grandson loved Elsa, and she took him to the store, and he wanted an Elsa hat with a pink pigtail, and she really struggled because of culture." She says, "What do I do if my boy's wearing a pink pigtail Elsa hat?" And she left the store not buying it because of her cultural fear. And she says, "I stopped the car, turned around, and went back, and he has an Elsa hat." She says, "I'm not buying into it." And we were there for baseball. My other grandson was playing baseball, and Donovan was running around with a flowing skirt and colorful up and down the bleachers and just going everywhere. And not a single person flinched. There was no hint. Everybody loves him because his mom says it's okay. She teaches them it's okay. They're safe. His mom says it's okay. They love him to death. You know, it's amazing. You know, a little difference we can make in that. Yeah. And some, you had a question back there.
I had seen a flyer, and it said that you were the leader of the group that was based on the movie Boy Erased.
Uh-huh.
And since you're the leader, I just watched the movie today.
Uh-oh.
Watching it.
Yes.
The leader was very abusive to young men, so was that exactly how you treated him?
No. It really wasn't, and that's been really hard for me. It's been hard for me to go through the Boy Erased book and the Boy Erased movie, and you know, I was a consultant on the film, and sort of. I mean, I was officially, I was hired as a consultant. Anyway, it was hard, because what the producer and the writer, Joel Edgerton, said to me, and in some interviews, the film was a composite of stories that he's heard. I'm sorry? Love in Action was Garrod's experience and the focus of his book. When they produced the film, I really wish they'd changed the name of the ministry in the film, because they changed all the people's names. I wish they'd changed the ministry name, because it did not reflect Love in Action. And there's lots and lots and lots of Love in Action people that are very upset about that, because they said, "That's not our experience." But, I'm sorry? I know of several who have committed suicide that went through the program. Yes. And as an experience, the film, my response to the film when I saw it, I went to the premiere in New York, and I, again, with Joel, I said, "Joel, here's my deal about the film. What I recognize about the film is all the names were changed, but the stories are true." And I said, "I know that everything represented in that film represents things that people have been through. It is not extreme. It is extreme if we compare it to the true Love in Action. But I can't be defensive about that, because it is true in people's lives. There are people who have experienced being called faggots by ministry leaders. There are people who have experienced people yelling and screaming at them. There are people who have experienced being beat by the Bible. There are people who have experienced parents who forced them into places and their mom stands in a corner and watches it happen, who later realizes she was wrong. There are people who have experienced everything in that film. And so I'm supportive of the film, and I stand behind it, because it is a true reflection of the LGBTQ experience. And I want that film to be out there."
And then we also just want to point out that that's how pervasive shame can be. So I think that's an important thing to understand. When he talks about his experience with Love in Action, I think that goes in line with what a lot of people have experienced in conversion therapy centers. They weren't abusive. There was just this theology that there's something in you that needs to be fixed. But I think it's good for all of us to understand that shame goes that deep. It doesn't require an abusive situation. You don't have to be hit with the Bible. You don't have to be beaten. Just this idea that there's something in you internally that must be fixed is enough to drive people to suicide. That's why we're here tonight, because right. It's not just these big acts like we see in Boy Erased. It's even just the small things that we say, the way you look at someone, a little boy who wears pink, the way we treat someone just for acting differently than we think they should. Those things are so shame-inducing that people will commit suicide. So it's not just, by any means, the things that would happen in that kind of therapy center. It's the stuff that we do to people every day and just the small things that we say.
And it happens in pastors' offices, and it happens all over everywhere. And it's sinister. And what I've said about this, if you're interested in kind of reading some of the things I've written of late, gracerivers.com, gracerivers.org, I think it is. Or is it .com? It's funny, I don't remember. I think it's .com. Anyway, Grace Rivers Ministry. It's on Facebook. I write blogs fairly regularly, and one of the ones I wrote just last week was called Was Love in Action Double-Minded? And that goes through what it's like to be double-minded in the double mixed messages that were sent. I also have my book available if you want to buy that. And the book takes us from 2005 to 2012, and it's in much greater depth the process that I went through during that transition. Each chapter is a blog, and it's chronological in terms of the way that book reads. And I'm not done. You know, just I appreciate your question about Boy Erased. I'm a part of a group of leaders called Former Ex-Gay Leaders Alliance, and we talk about all the time how many years it takes to come away from that kind of indoctrination. You know, I wasn't there because I hated people. You know, I was there because I was indoctrinated to a belief system. I was indoctrinated to believe that homosexuality was a devious, sinful, rotten, wretched abomination that had the power to kill someone. And everywhere I went, I was taught that. Every church, every lesson, everything I read, every organization I was a part of, because I was indoctrinated into that very, very narrow, cultish evangelicalism. And when you're in that kind of a situation, it is affirmed and affirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed. And so when we're there, we're taught with fear, with shame, with threats of harm by God. And so it became something for me that I truly believed I was preventing people from death. Soul, spiritual, physical, you know, there were suicides. The ones that I'm aware of, one happened shortly after the program, and there were many circumstances surrounding that situation, and Love in Action was a part of it, but it wasn't all of it. That's what I discovered. It's like Garrod, you know, Garrod came to Love in Action for a 9-day experience. His 9-day experience has become a worldwide a platform. But Garrod came to Love in Action after 18 years of living in a conservative evangelical home. So those messages came to him way before he ever came to Love in Action. And his dad, by his own admission, was a fire and brimstone preacher. And his mom, by her admission, was passive, and she did not step against that. Well, that's Garrod's history. And then he comes to Love in Action. So Love in Action becomes the platform that he uses to begin to process and speak out about the things that he's struggling with. And he has every right to his platform and to his process, because we all need to hear it. We need to listen to those kinds of things. But and so for me, it's taken me 10 years. You know, I go back, 2008 is when I left Love in Action. This is 10 years into 11 years, and I'm still every day shrucking things off, you know, trying to deal with detoxifying myself and deconstructing those things that I bought into for all those years.
All right. And so we're just going to start wrapping up there. Will you be around for a little bit?
Yeah.
So we just want to take some time to meditate, end in prayer. There were a couple things that he said that I think were very poignant. And the first thing he heard from somebody was, well, you know, the Bible says that's wrong. And he said, well, I didn't even know what the Bible said. And that's one of the things we've been focusing on here. We do want to know what the Bible says. And I'll be honest with you, there's a lot of gay Christians in this room that I know, and I think any of them could walk you through those passages right now. Most of them are really acquainted with their Bible because being a Christian is so important to them. But what I've really learned is that it's really our experience with people that changes us. If you've been able to see any of the Facebook posts this week, they've been really comical. People pop in and they say, that's not scriptural. And then we answer them with scripture. And then they go, oh, well, I don't like it. And so what we see is that it's really not a scriptural thing for most people. It's our culture. It's our culture that we impose onto the text and all sorts of things like that. And we can't change culture just by yelling Bible verses at people. We change culture by people being willing to share their experiences and put themselves on a line so people can hear what you've been through, see your relationship with God. That's what really changes people. So we're going to take this time now just to sit in prayer, because God did a cool thing for me this week. I was sitting in prayer, and out of nowhere, I just kind of hear his voice go, and I think I'm sarcastic, so maybe I'm sarcastic because God's sarcastic. And it's like, you think I would discriminate against the people group? And I was like, God, you know what? I don't think you would discriminate against the people group. My bad. But these are things that we discover in prayer. So we just want to take some time now just meditating on all the things that we had to learn right then about how God acted in his life. Questions you can ask yourself: what things really stood out to you while he was speaking? What parts of his life do you really identify with? And as he continues to see God change the way he sees God and he sees life and he sees people, how is God changing those things in your life? So we're just going to take next couple minutes. Just take some time and do that personally, your time with God.